Thanks, Jay. Yeah, I'm Lorna, I'm Laddict.
Hi, Lorna.
I am really nervous. I have to say, I'm very nervous. And I just wanted to say, because I sort of went for a quick loiter in the toilets to try and, like, calm my nerves. And Gabrielle, who's just sitting over there, just said to me, you know, you'll be all right, because they're all on your side. And that sort of really helped me. I can be a little bit cagey around myself, so I find it difficult. But, you know, I do know from experience that I'll be all right in a little while. It just sort of takes me a little while to... And I haven't been here before. I've never been to this meeting. I know lots of people in this meeting. In fact, I know quite a lot of people in this meeting. And so that's really helped. I'm an addict. That's why I come to Narcotics Anonymous. And I will show, you know, you said a little bit about not being a war story, you know, not doing a war story. I mean, I always think it's important for me to share a little bit about my experience and where I come from. And part of, because that's the sort of thing that I listened to when I came to meetings, because I was so damaged from using and damaged from my life experience and stuff that had gone on that... The only thing that really sort of kept me in the rooms was that I knew when I heard people speaking and they spoke about things that, you know, where they'd come from, things that they'd done and that. There was stuff that I never, ever thought that I would share to anybody because I was so full of shame and remorse and self-pity and, you know, and didn't know what I was going to do. So it was really helpful to me. And I'm going to try and stop saying anum because I can hear it again. I've already started. I can hear it. So I'm going to try and stop doing that. it didn't work. My mum and my dad were alcoholics. And I'm not going to sort of go into, like, you know, a family of history alcoholic story. But the reality is that was my life experience. My parents were alcoholics. My mum has four children, and we all wound up heroin addicts. My younger sister committed suicide 7 years ago because she couldn't stop using. She came to a few meetings, but she couldn't understand, she couldn't get it. And that was really difficult for me because I thought, you know, at that time I had some kind of power that I'd be able to, like, really give her a message of recovery. And it was really difficult for me to get to grips with the fact that I couldn't. All I could do was carry on doing what I'm doing. My older sister still uses. And my brother is a functioning, sort of, almost, alcoholic who's very seriously ill at the moment, but can't stop drinking. My early years, and I share this, you know, not because, it, you know, I don't know how I became an addict, whether I was born one, created one, however I became one. I just know that I am one. I know that my experience as a child was one of quite a lot of serious abuse, on all different scales. And from a very, very early age, I hated myself. I hated everybody. I lost connection with anything that was nice, and I stopped believing in people. And I think that, you know, back as a child, I spiritually disconnected. That's what I think. Because I remember being really, really young and praying. I remember that, and I didn't start the clock now. I remember being very young, and we used to have to pray, and then it stopped. You know, I don't remember when it stopped, but I just know that I got to a place where everybody, all the people that were around me, that now, if I look back and I can say that they should have cared and they should have done this, and, you know, they were responsible and that, they didn't. You know, it all fell apart, and our life was particularly painful and not nice. And I picked up from that. That's why the reason I say it is because I picked up this belief system about myself that I was unlovable. I didn't like myself. I didn't like other people. I didn't trust people. Everybody that I ever met let me down, abused me, or, you know, said that they would do things and they never. So I, from a very, very young age, I stopped believing in people. And I somehow in it, you know, I thought, I'm, you know, I don't consciously remember as a child saying I'm never going to, you know, there's a place in me. I remember as I got older thinking that I'm never going to, there's a part that I'll never ever let anybody access because it was just too painful. So by, you know, my life took, for, I was drinking very, very early. I progressed very quickly into using other substances, became promiscuous, very young. And by the time I got to the age of 12, just before, not to, a couple of months before my 13th birthday, I started trying to commit suicide because I hated life. I hated myself and I just didn't know what to do. I couldn't ask for help and nobody seemed to help me, really. No one seemed to tell me what to do. There wasn't anybody to show me. So I set off on this self-destruct, really. I guess that's what you could call it. And that's how my life carried on. I just got into situations that I couldn't get myself out of. And I'd do things that I couldn't live with. I'd do things that I'd find shame and remorse and guilt, you know, and I couldn't live with all them the stuff that was going on in my head with all, you know, all the past stuff. I was, if really what I'm saying is I was totally victimised by my childhood, and then when the drugs came along, it sort of stopped it. It helped me to be able to live. And I sort of look back and I think, because I was trying to, you know, kill myself from a very young age. And I think maybe if I hadn't taken drugs, you know, that would have been a reality somewhere along the line for me, because I just really didn't know how to live life. And nobody showed me. I hang around with lots of different people that I gravitated towards. People that were doing wrong things. There were people that were doing the right things, but I couldn't mix with them, you know, because I didn't do the right things. I couldn't get on at school. I couldn't stay in the classroom. I couldn't take, you know, instructions from teachers and stuff. And I couldn't. I told terrible lies. I was such a liar and such a thief. Like, before I even started taking drugs, I would tell the biggest lies on the planet, and I didn't even have to. I'd sort of make up stories because it sort of changed who I was, and for a minute, you know, I'd sort of half believed that was me. And I stole, you know, I stole when I was at school, and I kept getting caught. And I stole not for a gain. I didn't steal it because I needed to, you know, I didn't go out and I'm talking about in the infant school. I stole because I knew that I could get friends from it, because when I gave people things, they were my friend. But when I didn't have anything to give them, they weren't my friend. So I learned at a very young age, you know, my perspective of people very young was that when you had something, they wanted you. And when you didn't have anything, they didn't want you. So my view was very shallow and cynical of people. And I just carried on taking more drugs, living quite a rebellious life. And by the age of 16, I was in prison. I went to Germany and I wound up in prison for 6.5 months. I got a 2-year sentence for fraud and I did 6.5 months out there. And I came back, had my 17th birthday out there, and that was the first birthday that I'd had for a while then that I'd had clean. And I was really incensed because it was a Saturday night and I felt cheated that I, you know, I wasn't out getting drunk, like 17 years of age, and a Saturday night, and I wasn't able to go out and celebrate it. And the one thing that I remember really clearly about being in this prison in Germany was that I was on the young, there was 8 of us went, and 8 of us got arrested. And I was the only one under 21, the rest of them were all older, and so I was on a young person's wing, and there was about 24 people on there, and a good 21 of them were heroin addicts. And that's just how it was in Frankfurt. You know, lots of them worked on the streets and took heroin, and it was heavily populated. And I was quite fascinated by them, because they'd just fall asleep on, you know, come back, they'd go out for weekends. Their sort of system of prison, being in prison, was different to here, and they'd go out on the weekends and they'd come in. And I, there was something about them being, you know, almost comatose when they can come back, that, you know, it appealed to me. And I came back from, I got deported from Germany when I was 17, and people held a party for me. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, I felt really popular because they'd held this welcome home party. I felt like I'd really arrived. And it's quite, you know, it happened really quickly. It's like 1980, and within 4 weeks of coming back, I was using heroin. And within 4 weeks of that, I was injecting it. And I'd started injecting. I started going up to squats up Dog Kennel Hill. And the people that I was using with, you know, my using never started off in glamorous places. It wasn't in nightclubs or anything like that. It was in seedy places, squats, people that had been using for years, you know, and I was sort of fascinated because I had bits missing, like, you know, fingers gone and toes and ulcers and abscesses, and there was something about being, you know, in the surroundings that, you know, it's not that I thought, you know, wow, this is really great, but I just felt comfortable there, and I felt like I belonged, and I, you know, just fitted in. I very quickly got ill. I got hepatitis B when I was 18, and the reality was then I probably got hepatitis C as well, but they just didn't know about it. I couldn't inject safely, and I kept having overdoses, and all different things happened to me. And my answer to that, even back then, was never to stop using drugs. It was to manage it. I thought that if I managed it, like maybe smoking it, and just having a fix, like maybe at the weekends or every now and again, or if there was someone about that could help me. So my using as very young, 18, was always about managing, you know, not stopping. Even though I'd say back then that I could stop whenever I wanted to, I didn't actually want to at that age. There was nothing about my life that I wanted to stop using drugs, because it just fitted and it felt right. So the reality is that my life just carried on like that for years. I can just sort of fast forward the tape right up until 39 years of age when I actually got clean, and I just spent all that time using heroin, drinking, and still somewhere it crossed over from me being in charge of my using, it crossed over to I'm an addict, and I just manipulated the fact. I didn't have to come to, I say it quite often, I didn't have to come to Narcotics Anonymous to know I was an addict. I actually knew that very clear. I knew that I couldn't stop using drugs, and I would use that to, you know, with anybody that, you know, anybody that I could like ponce off of or blag with a story to anybody, just to get some money out of them, or a bit of gear or stuff like that. I've got two daughters, and I had them in active addiction, and I can sort of say I took methadone for 10 years trying to come off heroin, and the reality of that was I just used it to get up in the morning. I didn't actually, you know, because they tried to put me on a, so, you know, I'm really feeling a bit defensive. They tried to put me on a 12-week reduction script, and I was thinking, like, how dare they? You know, don't they realise I have a heroin addict? I have a heroin addiction, and 12 weeks, I'm not going to be cured in that time. So I got onto a maintenance script, and I just used on top of it. And I held, like, when I got pregnant with my daughter, I wanted to get clean, and I sort of told people that I was trying to get clean. And what I did was I sort of used... I still use my methadone, I'm still using heroin, but I took DFs, and I had it in my head that I was using DFs because I was trying to stop using. That was how my thought process went. And the reality was I used through both of my pregnancies. I had my daughters just over a year and 6 weeks apart. I didn't expect to get pregnant because I was like using it, just happened. Well, as it does, I guess. But I didn't think that I would have children, and I lived from my mum kicked me out of home because she couldn't cope with me. She kicked me out when I was 16, just nearly 16, and I lived right up until 28 when I had my first daughter. I just lived on the streets or in wherever I could find a bed, or just DOS. I used to live in King's College Hospital at one time down the end. They used to have these big armchairs, and the cleaners would come around at 7 o'clock in the morning and wake you up, and you had to leave. So when I got my daughter, when I had my daughter, I got my flat, and it was like quite, you know, it was a touch really that I'd got pregnant and I got a flat, and my flat actually turned it. I didn't know how to live in flat. I didn't know how to pay bills. I didn't even know how to furnish it really. I got behind very quickly. I wasn't signing on. I wasn't working. I wasn't doing anything. I was just going out, getting money, and getting drugs. So for the first few years, I was in and out of problems with the council, wanting to kick me out. I couldn't manage. I had threatening letters coming through thick and fast, and I couldn't manage any of that kind of stuff. And very quickly, I'd have to not let people in. I got cut off from electric. I'd no electric in my flat for 8 years, the last 8 years of my using. and I lived in there with two children. And it was like a squat, but with a rent book. That's how my living became. And I'd been smoking heroin for about 14 years till my lungs nearly packed up. And what I actually, because my hearing is, I don't hear what people say. I hear what I think that they mean when they say something. I sort of twist it, and you know, by the time it comes out, it's gone. You know, I've sort of added a meaning onto it. It's like quite strange. So I went to the hospital, and the doctor said to me, "If you have another attack like that, you'll die. Your lungs, you'll die." That's what he said to me. And what I actually heard was, if you have another attack like that, you'll die. So you need to go out of here and get needles and vitamin C and start fixing again, because that's the only way that you're not going to die. That's sort of, you know, he didn't say that, but that's what I thought, that, you know, he said what he meant, and that's what I did. And that's what I did. And I just, I mean, I didn't really want to stop using it at first, to be quite honest. I just wanted my problems to stop. They were getting bigger and bigger, and people were asking me why my kids weren't going to school, and I'd no electric, no money. People stopped wanting me around there. They just didn't want anything to do with me, and it was horrible. I'd have rows with everybody. I'd be aggressive in the school. My neighbours all felt that, you know, they came. My abuse spilled out all over, you know, everybody that I came into contact with. I was just so caught up in my using that I just couldn't even deal with people. And that's just how my life was. There was a couple of, I won't go right into it, but there was a couple of deaths that really affected me, and they started me thinking, I can't live this life anymore. The biggest one being, which I just shared very quickly, was about someone using. It was a friend of mine, been a friend for a long, long, 20 odd years, and she died in a bedroom, and they chucked a quilt over her, shut the door, and carried on using in there for 3 months, and while she decomposed in the bedroom. And that was the first time I'd ever thought to myself, you know what, I've done lots of things, but that's one thing that I thought, I'm not, you know, that's just like, just too much, I can't do that. And I was going to this project, and I said, what can I do? And she said, go to a detox. And my biggest fear there was that I'd lose my kids. So she said, assured me, no, you won't. And the reality was, I went to the detox. I didn't want to stop using. I wanted to manage. I just wanted the problems to go away. And I wanted to be able... I wasn't going to stop drinking, that's for sure. I wanted the problems to stop, and I wanted to be able to carry on drinking and use at the weekends. And I did a detox, and I went to rehab for a week, and I couldn't bear that, because I couldn't listen to people talking to me all about, you know, all these groups and what I should do and stuff, and I just couldn't get my head around it all, confront boards and keeping diaries on people. And I thought, I haven't got time for all this. I'm flipping, need to know how to not use, like, just worried about who's put toilet rolls in the toilet and sticking your name up on the board. I found it so petty. And you know, within a week of being in there, I was drinking. And then, you know, very quickly, I was getting my daughter to bring me up drink, and someone was in there using, so, you know, piled up there and using, and I was out of there, back to my flat. And the only thing that I remembered about that time was being in the detox and people from H&I, from Narcotics Anonymous, coming in. And I loved what they shared. I thought it was great. I could really identify with lots of things. But at that time, I had no intentions of not drinking. It just wasn't even an option for me. In my head, I just found the whole... I thought it was preposterous. I thought, what a load of rubbish. You know, that's just stupid. How can they say, like, you can't have a drink? Like, that's just terrible. And so I thought, you know, that was my agenda. That's what I wanted to do. And the reality was that I relapsed. And then the next 9 months almost was just awful, because I'd seen people, I'd got clean for a little bit of time, and I knew that I didn't have to be using, and my worst fear came true, and I did lose my kids. The social services came in, and I had no option but to let them go, and that for me was just awful. I had this social worker come into my flat, and my flat was just terrible. It was just awful. There was just, my mum took 62 bags of rubbish out of my flat when I was in detox. And she'd tell you that proudly. She was, you know, she thinks that's really great, you know, story to dump on people. I've lost my train of thought for a minute, sorry. Um, Yeah, I it doesn't matter. I don't know where.
Social worker.
Sorry. Oh yeah, the social worker. Thanks. he came. My flat was just awful. And what I did was, because he dropped a card through my door and said, "I need to come into your flat." He actually said, "Like, I'm coming into your flat, and if you don't let me in, I'm coming back to the police." So I was thinking, God, what am I going to do? You know, I'd lived a life where I'd drag the mattress into the front room, and, you know, when the front room got too dirty, I'd drag it back in the bedroom, and then that'd get to him, and I'd go and, like, it was just, you know, I had, like, about 3 sets of clothes that I would rotate round and step out there and step back in and round, you know, and they all seemed, you know, that set seemed a little bit better than that one, and, you know, it was filled with, like, stuff that I'd dragged in off the streets and just rubbish everywhere, and I thought, oh God, you know, what am I going to do? And my answer was sort of like pushed it all back and threw sheets over it, you know. And I sort of got all these posters that my daughter had and put them up on the wall with toothpaste. And I was thinking, it actually looks quite. It looks all right. It's not too bad, because by my standards, it was really nice. You know, it looked a bit brighter than it was. And when he came in, he's just stunned, really, you know, shocked, and the reality was that he took my children away, packed a little bag of clothes that they could find there, and it was horrible because I had to watch when as they walked away with them, and it was awful because for me at that point I knew then that I just could not control what I was doing. I knew that using for me was finished at that point, even though I went and used, because I just didn't know what to do. I decided that I would go back to detox because that's all I could do. I didn't have any other plans. I just thought, I'm going to have to try and stop using because I've got nothing now. It's all, you know, gone upside down. I was going to say something else and I'll try not to. So I went back to the detox and I went back there. You know, I say like broken in essence, but I'd picked up an air of humility going back to the detox. So the only one thing that I knew that I would do was when the people from Narcotics Anonymous came back in, that I was going to go to the meetings. I didn't really care for a lot that was going on in detox. I didn't like the groups. I didn't like drawing people on trees and relaxation and stuff. I just thought, oh God, like not all that sort of stuff. Even though, like, you know, I was really, like, keen then and getting people to groups, like, morphed from not wanting to do them to, like, making everyone else has to come to them as well, because I am. And I wanted to go to the meetings, and that's what I did. I went to the meetings and, you know, I say, because if it wasn't for people doing H&I service, you know, I know people do PI service as well, but the way I heard about the message of Narcotics Anonymous was in the detox. I'd heard years ago, I remember someone coming round when we were all using and he was flashing these key rings, you know, and like everybody was still using there, and as soon as he went away they were going, what a mug, you know, like God, what an idiot, you know, and it's sort of, that's all I knew was that, you know, you turned into an idiot and you flashed your key rings like that, people that was using, that's so, like, so I'm not going there, that's for sure. And but when I actually, in the detox, first of all, there was nothing to do, so that's why I went in there in the first time. But the second time I went to detox, I knew that people were telling. I knew, you know, I couldn't lie to myself. And I guess that's the first part of breaking some kind of denial in me. And I wanted so desperately to not be using. It's just I didn't know how to. I knew I had to stop, obviously. I knew that if I didn't take drugs in my system, I could cluck and be all, you know, then I wouldn't. But I didn't know how to do the rest after that, because as soon as you clucked, then you were well again and you could use, you know, safely. And, you know, you wouldn't. It's that mentality type of stuff. So I didn't actually know how to do the next part, and that was to live in my life. So I left from the detox, and I remember people saying to me, go to a meeting, you know, when you leave, go to a meeting. So that's what I did. I went back to my flat, and I didn't have my kids. My flat was just a nightmare. It was awful. I went back to where the flat I'd been using in for, at that point, about 11 years. And my dealer still lived next door but one to me. And the flat was in a terrible state, and I still had no electric. But I went back there, and I just started very slowly. I just have to, like, paint, you know, a little bit of the wall at a time. and try and clean little bits, just because I couldn't really manage too much. I started going to meetings, and I started for about 10 days. I went to meetings, and I didn't get on with people. And I think a lot of that was because in the beginning I'd sort of go in, I'd share, and then I'd feel really embarrassed and I'd have to leave. And I thought, they're not really very friendly, all of these people. They say they are. I hear them saying all these things, but I don't really... They're not friendly, because nobody reached out to me. I mean, I looked a mess. I have to say, the end of my using, I was a mess. You know, my using took me to fixing in bin cupboards in Camberwell with my kids standing on the door and using, you know, sitting in the park drinking tins of beers. It wasn't a glamorous type of using. I had cirrhosis, hepatitis B, my facial features, my body, I was just emaciated as a person. So it was just horrible. Using for me is a soulless place. That's the sort of place that I don't want to go back with. I know that my feelings inside were so hopeless, so full of despair and hating myself with a passion, and just feeling that there wasn't really much point in being part of life. And when I listened to people in meetings, they sort of said that people that I heard, they'd been to that kind of place and they weren't there anymore. They were doing things differently. So I went to this, you know, as Chris mentioned to me, it was a Friday lunchtime meeting in Camberwell, 1 o'clock, which has now gone. It used to be in the probation. And there was two women doing the shares, and I have to say, I hated them from the minute I sat there. I just thought, go away. You know, they were saying about how happy they were, and their jobs, and their boyfriends, and their cars, and their sunglasses on their head, and they were made up. And I just thought, oh, piss off. Like, it was just, I hated them. I really hated them. And, you know, when I look back, it was, there was everything, you know, sitting in front, everything about them was everything that I thought I could never be, and you know, and it was really difficult for me to look at them. And one of them took my, you know, because I haven't shared this for a long time. One of them actually took my phone number, and I remember thinking, she's only doing that so that everyone can see. You know, that's what that's all about. You know, come and take your number in front of everyone, so everyone go, oh, look at her, she's a good sort. And I thought, I won't hear from her. And really, it was. I got, you know, about 20 minutes after I left the meeting, and she sent me this text, and it's sort of, as you press the thing, they drop down, you know, and I'd only just got a mobile phone. I didn't really understand how it was working. First of all, it just had an S on it. I was thinking, that's a strange message. Like, why would someone just send me an S? You know, but then as I worked it out, you dropped it down the page, and it spelled out the word smile, and then it said at the bottom, smile, because you just got a text from someone who was thinking about you. And I cried. I couldn't believe that she had sent me this text. It really sort of touched me. And I thought, well, I might go back to these meetings then. I might sort of give them another chance. And, you know, I just might go back there. And that's what I did. I did go back. And I remember people suggested lots of things to me. They, you know, one of the things that they suggested to me was, you know, to stick around, to share honestly, get a sponsor. I thought, I don't want a sponsor. And to be of service. So, first of all, I couldn't really be of much service, even though I wanted to. I think I was about 8 months clean when I took my first meeting, and that was the 1 o'clock meeting in the lunchtime meeting in Camberwell. And I very quickly, it not many people used to go to it, see, and I was doing the literature, I was doing the tea, and we didn't have a GSR there, and I was taking the meeting, and I took it upon myself, if they cancelled it, I'd stand outside the meeting for the whole hour and a half to let people know that the meeting wasn't on, because I thought that's what you did, you know, sort of put a notice on there, and I was thinking, these poor people are going to be coming from work, and wherever it is they're coming from, and they're not going to know what's happened. I was so, like, big rescue of anybody. And, you know, for me it worked, because I was in my element. I felt really important, and I felt part of it. And people got to know who I was. They spoke to me. I even saw people in the street and they'd speak to me, which was quite, you know, a new experience for me, because most people avoided me. And I carried on going to the meetings. I got to about 5 months clean, and I started hanging about outside the meetings, having a fag. I'd listen to the share sometimes, or I'd listen and think, oh, well, nothing for me in that share. And I didn't understand all, you know, sitting and trying to listen. I heard people say similarities and differences, and I didn't really, I'd say it, I'd quote it, but I didn't really understand what they meant. You know, all I knew was that some people irritated me and I couldn't listen to them, so I'd go outside the meeting and have a fag. And I was at a meeting in Redpost Hill, which is a meeting that I go to regular, when I saw this woman came in, and she was so honest, and something she shared about being all spiritual and lovely on the phone to all people in the fellowship and that. But when her kids are there, she's like threatening them with a shoe, like, go away. And I thought, I can identify with that. I understand that. I gravitated straight away, and I thought, this, I have to ask this woman to sponsor me, and I didn't even know her. And so I followed her out to where you make the coffee and that in the kitchen. And I couldn't ask her, so I was sort of hanging around behind her. And then she went back in. I was thinking, oh no, I've missed the opportunity. And then she decided that she was leaving the meeting early, so I had to like run out after her and quickly say, "Will you be my sponsor?" So no, I said temporary sponsor. Will you be my temporary sponsor? And she said, "Well, I don't, you know, I haven't got that much time." And I said, "I don't care. I don't care." And she said, "I'll take my number and then phone me." And I didn't phone her for about 3 months because I was too scared. I did eventually phone her, and I started working steps with her. And that's really where recovery for me took off, because I started to be honest about myself. I realised, like when I did step one, I realised that I was a victim of my past, and it just horrified me. I thought I was a survivor. I didn't actually realise that I was victim. I didn't realise that, you know, that everything that had happened to me, I'd sort of carried on. You know, I left home when I was, you know, nearly 16, and it didn't stop. I just sort of took it with me. Thanks. So, I started working the steps, and I got a different image of myself, I guess that's a way to put it. And I realised that, you know, as time went on in the fellowship, and I started going to more meetings, I made myself of service, I helped other people, I tried to do what was suggested of me, and I listened to other people. I had a lot of rebuilding to do in my life, which I thought would be an impossible task. I never went to... I left school really early. I stopped going. They let me, like, leave when I was 15. They just said, don't bother coming back. I didn't take exams and that kind of stuff. I had massive debts. You know, it took me 5 years in recovery to pay off my rent arrears. And I couldn't move. I was a tolerated trespasser for the first 5 years of my recovery. And I managed to get that paid off. And it's really quite strange how it happened, because it was paid off in the December. And I spoke to this really nice woman in the council, and she put me straight back on the list to bid. And, you know, the first week in January, I bid on a three-bedroom flat, and I got it straight away, even though, like, all the people from the Aylesbury were put onto the list. So I think that was, like, because, you know, I don't know. It just seemed like one of them strange things that happen. I've done lots of things in recovery, which I'm really proud of. I've educated myself, not me personally. I've gone to college and become educated. And I've recently got a job, and I'll show it very quickly. I've recently got a job, 8.5 years on benefits, and I've just got a job, and I'm working in prison. And I can't believe it. I'm sort of wandering around, letting myself in and out of cells and working with prisoners. 12-step programme is fantastic. I'm really enjoying it. My life has completely changed. I've learned that I can be loved and that I am lovable. And for me, that's a really big thing, because it's something that I've never believed, and I still have my moments where I think, oh, I don't know. But they're not, as, you know, when I first came into recovery, my moments of negativity and bad feeling were huge, and they were always there. Now I get just small. You know, the majority of the time I'm really happy and I really like my life. My daughters, I got my children back just before I was a year clean. One of them's just gone off to university, and the other's repeating 2 years of college. Like, she's doing a different set of A levels and going on to university next year. That's her plan. I can't believe it. Things have just happened. All I've done is I've tried to do what's suggested. I've been of service to other people. I think that's so important, you know. And my love in Narcotics Anonymous is hospitals and institutions. I'm just eternally grateful for people coming in there and sharing that, you know, if I wanted a different way of life and if I did want to stop using, if I did want to do something different, I could. And so if you are new around, don't, you know, just keep coming to meetings. I with suggestions, I think sometimes I'd say look at what the person's doing in their programme, you know, because some people's suggestions, you know, they might be like a little bit unwell and they might not have worked any programme. So, like, well, look at the people that are, you know, strong in recovery in meetings and ask them what they're doing and, you know, don't lose hope. Like, I could have done, but I didn't. There was something about coming to meetings and just hanging on to the belief that recovery for me was possible. And so if you are new, just keep coming back. Thanks.